Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando. Jeffrey Deskovic was going to be our guest today and unfortunately is not able to make it. He did have someone call me, and we do have a guest coming on. However, it was such short notice, I forgot to send the invitation, and I'm trying to get the number for her, which she is on. Great. Okay. Evie, are you on with us?
I'm on.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to introduce you now. We just started, but I was just telling the audience, our guest Jeffrey Deskovic will not be able to be with us today. He will be back with us next Thursday, June 2nd, 2022 at the same time. However, he did send someone our way who I'm very honored to have on, and I'm going to first tell a little bit about her. Shackled, ankles bloodied, shivering in a t-shirt with a temperature barely above 30. This was Evie Litwork's introduction to the federal women's prison. She experienced firsthand life behind bars. In prison, she wrote an article on the death of a fellow inmate due to lack of medical care. Her unapologetic voice as a woman, an LGBTQ advocate, and an open lesbian made her a target, resulting in a transfer to solitary confinement. Leaving prison homeless and penniless, Evie Litka continued her advocacy. She became a founding member of the National Criminal Justice LGBT HIV Working Group, focusing on sexual violence in confinement. She convened formerly incarcerated LGBTs, sexual violence survivors, on a sexual violence in confinement. She convened formerly incarcerated LGBT sexual violence survivors in a report called Sexual Violence Against LGBTI People in Confinement. There is no Me Too movement behind bars, featured on the DOJ, the Department of Justice National PREA Resource Center website. And for those of you who are not familiar with PREA, it's a Rape Elimination Act. Litwork is a respected speaker on criminal justice. A formerly incarcerated Jewish lesbian, her story spreads nationwide. She has spoken for the White House panel on LGBTQ's criminalization. Witness to mass incarceration was born from her struggles inside the prison system. Its mission is to promote voices of formerly incarcerated women and LGBTQs in finding alternatives to mass incarceration. And Ms. Litwork has a MA, Master's in Psychology, which is another attribute to her already mount of achievement. She has been a true warrior in the advocacy field, both for the LGBTs, female prisoners, and mass incarceration, which we all know is way out of control. So let us welcome Ms. Evie Litwork. Evie, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate your coming on and telling your story.
It's my pleasure.
So would you please introduce yourself a little bit more, tell the audience a little bit more of what you went through? I can do an introductory, but I was not there to experience all that you went through, and you have gone through hell and back. So I'd like to have you talk to the audience and let them know what you experienced and how you came about founding your organization.
So I will give you a little bit of my story, and then we will. Then you'll probably have a series of questions, I'm sure.
Okay.
So I was living with my mother in 2009 and 10, just before I went to prison. I was her caretaker. She is a survivor of the Holocaust. She was in Auschwitz, and the time I was living with her, couldn't see, she couldn't hear, but she went with me to sentencing and begged the judge. She said, "I'm a survivor of the Holocaust. I've had enough pain for a lifetime. My daughter, she's been a wonderful daughter. please let her stay home. I will die without her. I won't even be able to survive one day. To which she said, I don't care. She's going to prison. So we drove home, and you unpack for prison. You take off jewelry. You take off everything. And she walked into my room and looked at me, said very seriously, all 4'9" of her, said, I need to talk to you. And she said, prison is going to be harder for you than concentration camp was for me. And I said, Mom, are you crazy? You were in Auschwitz. How can you compare the two? She said, I was 12. You are 60. And it would be years later when I was in solitary confinement that her words would come back to me. I was young, a child. I didn't know what was going on. You're an old woman. I was 60. And aware of what you lost, and you will see your life every day. And she was right. The moment that I entered prison, I knew I was no longer in the free world. An officer took me immediately into an old and dingy room, and I was told to strip naked in front of the officer. I was ordered to pee in front of her, then to lift my breasts so she could check for contraband, and then I had to bend over and cough so she could check that I had no drugs or paraphernalia in either my anus or my vagina. And at that moment, I was more humiliated than at any other time in my life. I knew I couldn't scream or cry, and I knew I had to shut down and not respond to anything. And I had to find a set of coping skills that didn't exist prior to that moment. And so then I was sent to an orientation unit, and veterans walk over to you and tell you if you want to do easy time, you need to stay under the radar. No officer should know your name. The warden shouldn't know your name. Well, I'm 70 years old. I was a baby of the women's gay rights and civil rights movement. So I was an old, experienced activist. I didn't and couldn't check my activism at the door. And it took less than an hour for me to be on literally everybody's radar. And this is how it happened. Everyone asks the newbies, are you married? Do you have kids? So now you're also allowed to bring pictures in, 25 pictures in. So the first person walks over to me and says, are you married? Do you have kids? And I said, no. Second person, are you married? Do you have kids? I said, no, I'm not married. I don't have kids. And after the fourth person walked over to me, I realized I've been out for 40 years, and I'm not going back in the closet. And the first person I came out to was my wonderful mother, who said to me, if Hitler didn't kill me, you will, which I thought at the time was very funny. But anyway, the next person who walked over to me said, are you married? Do you have kids? I said, I'm not married. I don't have kids. And I'm a lesbian. And so this young woman said, can I see your pictures? And it just so happened that I had 25 pictures of my dog, Allie, who's a 16-year-old Maltese. And she screamed out, this old white lesbian has 25 pictures of her dog. And within 1 hour, all 1,300 women on the compound, all officers knew that I had come out. And it turned out to be very, very dangerous for me, and I did not do easy time. And that's just the beginning of my story. So I can dig into the story much further, you know, if you give me a sense of how much time I have, which I should have asked you before I started.
We have an hour. We do have an hour. We have plenty of time.
Okay. So I was in a unit that was a quiet unit, and within a week, the unit manager called me into her office, and I had no idea why. And she opened by saying, I understand you're an open lesbian. And I could feel myself getting angry. And I said, I'm also an open Jew and an open feminist. And she said, several women have complained that you're touching their buttocks. And I looked at her, and I practically wanted to strangle her. I said, how dare you accuse me? I haven't been with a woman in 10 years. You think I would start in here? And I demanded to meet my accusers, and I forgot that I was in prison. Thought I was in court. And she said, just go. And by the time I walked to my bed, I was being moved to a very difficult unit intentionally. Bed was put at a place called the bus stop. And this was a punishment place where you would sleep. and this was only 10 days into my prison sentence. Now, the bus stop, each unit had about 150 women in it, and the bus stop was in front of the 150 women that were sleeping. So at night, and prisons are built with fluorescent lighting through the entire ceiling, and they're designed that way to give you a headache, or they cause seizures. The lighting system is so intense that a lot of women suffer vertigo, migraines, seizures, who never had it before. It's all due to the lighting. Anyway, I was put on the bus stop as punishment, and at 11 o'clock when the lights go out, it was dark behind me in the sleeping unit, but the lights that were above the bus stop where I was sleeping were left on all night. And right in front of me was the ice machine, which cracked down every 20 minutes. And to the sides of the bed were bathrooms, which all 150 women were flushing toilets or showering. And there was no way to sleep, and that was the point. And I was told that I was being punished or kept on the bus stop because I came out as a lesbian. Now, religion is the only place in prison that where you get to pick what religion you are, and you can change as often as you like. So you can be Jewish on Monday, and the following Monday you can be Muslim, and you can change. That's the only area prison has no control over. And I am Jewish, and for 45 years, I did not attend regular services. You know, I was 60 when I entered prison, and the last time I had been to regular services was my brother's bar mitzvah that long ago. But when I walked into prison, I immediately wanted a prayer book, something that I never owned in my life. And I found myself saying a Hebrew prayer, a short one, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. I was saying this prayer under my breath over and over and over again. And I was stunned at how comforting this was for me. And I can tell you that most people probably never had a lot to do with religion and needed to have some faith. And in prison, they got it. And I can tell you that I started going to services, and I've never stopped. And I'm out of prison 8 years. Because it kind of saved my life to be able to connect that way. Now, all women are forced to work. Most older women like me are given indoor jobs where they could sit down after they finish their task. I was ordered to sweep the streets. I was ordered to sweep rocks off the street with a broom, not pebbles, rocks. And they did that intentionally. They put me in 90 to 100 degree weather to punish me for coming out and being out. And when I went that first day to sweep the rocks off the street, a memory of a story my mother told me came into my mind. I had never met my mother's father, my grandfather. My mother described him as a tall, handsome man with jet black hair and a jet black beard. And after the Germans came into Poland in 1939, they rounded up all the religious and business leaders, all men, and took them away for 3 weeks. They were beaten relentlessly, and when they were brought home, my mother was frightened when she saw her tall, black-haired father being completely gray and permanently bent over from the beatings. And to further humiliate the men, the Nazis made the men sweep the streets in front of their wives and children. And as I was sweeping the streets of prison every day, I could feel my grandfather, who I never met, sweeping beside me. So, as I said, the one area you get to choose what to do is religion. And there is a Jewish holiday called Passover. And 6 weeks before that holiday, we get a list of kosher for Passover items you could buy one time once a year that included chocolate macaroons, chocolate-covered matzah, and food that you don't get on a prison compound. So when that list comes out, I had about 20 women sitting by me saying, I want in on this. I want some of that matzo stuff. However, 6 weeks before the list came out, 35 women converted to Judaism, which was hysterical. And women who, so we were permitted two nights of 5 hours each night to go through the service. And that is another reason people converted, to get 5 hours away from hell for two nights. And once this holiday was over, Ramadan came and everybody converted to Muslim. And, and if they wanted to go to the Native American sweat tanks, they would convert to something else. They converted to whatever religion had an event. Now, in prison, medical care is essentially non-existent. Women with serious conditions are not sent out for scans or MRIs. If you came to prison with cancer, you're going to die. If you got cancer in prison, even if caught early, it was a death sentence. We had one physician's assistant who saw all 1,300 women. Whether you came in with a headache, a broken foot, cancer, or cyst, you got the same speech, which is you're fat, walk on the track, and drink water. Well, one woman, Miriam Hernandez, went in to see the physician's assistant for severe stomach pain. She couldn't move. He gave her the fast speech and sent her back to her unit. 2 weeks later, she died when her gallbladder burst. And I was so upset that I wrote a story about the officer's failure to do a simple blood test. And I blamed him, without naming him, for her unnecessary death. And instead of snail mailing the article, I emailed it, and the officers read all emails. So an hour after it was posted to my website, I was arrested, shackled, and sent to solitary confinement. And I was told I would be there for as long as they wanted to keep me there because I wrote about an officer. So solitary is a prison within a prison run by a few people, and they get to do whatever they want. They answer to no one. The primary reason in women's prisons why solitary or the SHU segregated housing is filled with 60 women is because it's used for retaliation and mostly around sexual relationships. If officers wanted to have sex with you, you were in a position where you almost had to say yes. So I heard an officer, I'll give you an example, walk over to a young mother, and 70% of the women in prison are young mothers. And he said, do you want to see your kids this weekend? And she looked at him, of course. And he said, then I want a blowjob. And if you don't do that, you're either going to be sent to solitary or worse, transferred hundreds of miles away so that your family would never see you. And that's why solitary was filled.
Evie, can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. How long was the sentence you were given?
2 years.
So you were in, this is all happening in 2 years?
This is, I haven't even gone 3 months into prison. This is all happening.
Wow. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. You can ask me if you have other questions. It's fine to ask.
You know, I really do, because I don't know if you heard what happened in the Lowell prison in Florida, but all these women were raped by the guards there. And I have a real problem with male guards in female prisons and female prison guards in male prisons. But also what you're going through, I know that I've interviewed others, other women too, that have gone through the same thing, and I just can understand, and I can almost feel what you were going through at that time, and it's probably left all kinds of scars in your memories of that 2 years incarcerated.
It wouldn't matter if it was 2 weeks or 2 years or 20. The damage done by the trauma of being in prison, the minute you walk in, you're treated as if you're a wild animal who has no dignity. And I have to understand, my parents are Holocaust survivors, so I grew up knowing how Nazis treated Jews. So I was seeing the same thing happen to me in a different situation. And officers are trained part of the training is not to be sensitive to your needs.
I wish you could have been on yesterday. Every Wednesday, I interview Mariam Jacobs from the Netherlands, and she is a psychosocial therapist. She's been in the prisons in the U.S., and she also has done volunteer work in the prisons in the Netherlands. But she talks about the comparison between the prisons there and the prisons here. And what she has said over and over again is the prisons in this country have been built pretty much like the Nazis, with the Nazi mentality, and that's what it is, because the prisons out there are not built like with the steel bars and the steel walls and the cement. They're not, and they, as you said, they call you all kinds of names. And she was saying that the guards there, they treat the prisoners humane. They don't call them by numbers. They don't mistreat them and do the things that they do here. So everything that you're saying about the Holocaust is what these prisons pretty much have been built on, the same mentality.
Except without the gas chambers.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it's what's important to remember is not so much that it's a comparison, but that when one group of people have power over another, that it's very sick. And people do things that are horrendous, and people will continue to do things. People who want to stay in power don't care what it is they do in order to step on you, which is part of the problem. But
click on this one. We have a caller. Caller 323, please state your name.
My name's Joe. Hello, Leona.
How are you, Joe?
I
don't know if you've been listening in, but we have a guest on right now, and she's talking about the time that she spent in incarcerated and what she had to go through. And her parents were Holocaust survivors, so she's talking about that as well. So, Evie, if you can continue, please do.
Oh, does he have a question, or do I keep talking?
Do you have a question?
No, I'm going to put myself on mute. I just see that my phone is only 1% charge left. I'll have to call back in probably in a few more minutes.
Okay.
I'll put myself on mute for now.
Okay, thank you. Okay, you can go ahead, Evie, please continue.
Sure. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it's like to be in solitary confinement. So you're strip searched, you're given a t-shirt, shorts, underwear, and a jumpsuit, you get a thin blanket. The temperature is kept freezing. And when you ask for a second blanket, you're denied. And the best way for people in the audience to understand what it's like to be in solitary is to commit to going into your bathroom at home, not your college dorm where there's four cells, but just your individual bathroom in your apartment. And imagine that you have the toilet seat, but it's a metal one where is a metal bed and there's a metal sink, no window, and you don't have a computer, you don't have a phone, you don't have books, you don't have knitting, you have nothing to do. How long can you sit either on your toilet or on the bed or stand up in your own bathroom? And it's a test I ask people to try. Because usually you can do it for about 20 minutes before you start to go crazy. And the difference is you can walk out of there. But for most people, once you're put in solitary, it is a very frightening experience to know that you're locked in and you can't get out. And that does not leave you. I'm out of prison 8 years, and I have triggers and traumas from that experience that I never know I'm going to have. So
I was going to say, that's what I was going to say when I talked about Mariam Jacobs, because she talks about the psychological damage that is done because people are kept in solitary and on restrictive blocks with nothing. I don't know if you got to see, there was an article or some statement on Facebook about four or five months ago, about a person that was kept in solitary confinement for 695 days, and when he came out, he came out barking like a dog. The thing is, it's even with the pandemic. It's the pandemic, by the way, started on Passover in 2020. I don't know if you remember that, but it started right around the Passover of the Jewish and also of the Christ Jesus. And that was around March or April of 2020. And it's going on 3 years now. And people, there are still people that are in solitary confinement that have no television, even restrictive housing, no way to know what's going on the outside. And like you mentioned, the bathroom, I think about it all the time. I can't stand to be in one room for more than an hour or two. I'm walking around to the kitchen or the living room. These people have no place to go. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think society is very cruel when they can expect anybody to be in solitary or in restrictive blocks or to be confined with nothing. And one lawyer said one time, a lawyer from Florida said that's what they call psychological torture.
Yeah. Well, it's true, and you don't recover from that. But I'll just point out that the longest-serving incarcerated person was from, they took the Black Panthers and threw them in prison and threw them in solitary. So the longest, one of the longest-serving members of the Black Panthers was in solitary for 43 years. And when I met him, what I'll tell you is he was the most zen person I had ever met because he had to be. He had to find a way to cope with being in there for 43 years, talking to nobody, having nothing to do. And it was remarkable how clear his mind was given those circumstances. You know, part of understand that people, and I'll just jump to this for a second, which is people who survive prison are amazing people. They, whatever crime they committed, and it doesn't matter what it is, you go to prison to lose your freedom. You don't go to prison to have your life be at risk.
Exactly.
And once you're in prison, your life is at risk. You're dealing with physical abuse, sexual abuse, all kinds of mental abuse. And if you survive that experience, you want to come out and you want to start all over again. So I'll take you through a minute more of solitary, but reentering this world is harder than being in prison. But before I get there, I just want to tell you a few minutes of my experience in solitary. So within a couple of hours, I started to get migraines, which I never had, vertigo, which I never had, and I could tell my blood pressure, and I did have an issue, was off the charts. And when I begged them, because I had, you know, both sides of my family had heart disease, when I begged them to take my blood pressure, they didn't do it for 2 weeks. And when they did, it was 200 over 100. And I asked, isn't it time to take me to the hospital? And the guard left and said, well, we get $75,000 if you die in prison off of your policy, which was probably not true, but that's what he said. You get a roll of toilet paper, and when you ran out, the guard looked at me when I asked him for a second roll, and he looked at me with a straight face and said, wipe yourself. And I would not give him the satisfaction of moving even one facial muscle to tell him I was upset about that, even though I was. And you have 60 women screaming simultaneously for 24 hours a day. And what they were screaming where I was is, get me the fuck out of here. But to this day, I hear that noise. It's never gone away. Mm-hmm. And many people tried to commit suicide, and some succeeded. And if they did, you heard them succeed. They were next door to you. Now, I personally didn't want to kill myself. I'm not suicidal. I'm quite the opposite. I'm quite positive. I'm quite optimistic. However, during solitary and one other time when I was during reentry, during solitary, I looked up to God and I said, I've had a great life and it would be really okay if I didn't wake up tomorrow. I was kind of asking God to take me. Now, I was released shortly after my time in solitary. And like I said, coming home was worse than being in prison. I was one of 700,000 people who come home every year. I was put on a Greyhound bus, given $30, sent to Port Authority, where I was met by no one. My mom was still alive, but she wasn't well, and I had no relationship with my brother or his family. And I was homeless and penniless for 16 months. I went to nonprofits that served formerly incarcerated people, and you get a resume, 2 weeks of employment training, you know, a Metro card. You get transactional stuff, but you can't cobble a life together with a Metro card and a resume. You need much, much more help, which is not provided. And I also had a 30-year work history. I worked 12 years on Wall Street, 10 in nonprofits, and I sent out 200 resumes, but I could not, 200 job applications, but I didn't get a single response. And I understood poverty for the first time when I had to decide whether to eat a 30-cent bagel or a dollar slice of pizza on a daily basis. That was all I could afford. Now, after being homeless for 16 months, an old friend named Irva Shivad, and I say her name, she just passed away from cancer and is one of the most remarkable people I ever knew. And if people get a chance, Masha Gessen has written a beautiful article about her, which is in the New Yorker magazine. And I talked about this in the article. I ran into her at an event. I hadn't seen her in 20 years. I walked over. I said, Irv, do you remember me? She says, Evie, don't be ridiculous. And she had just been a breast cancer survivor. So she was telling me about that. And she said, where have you been? I said, prison. And she did not leave my side until she found me housing and in senior low-income housing. And when I walked in, it was an adorable studio. And I hadn't had my own space in some 20 years. I mean, my own space post-prison. And I said, Irv, if I take this, then my Social Security will pay for rent, and I'll have nothing left for myself. You know, I can't eat. And she said, don't worry, I'll get you a job. I said, Irv, you're not going to be able to get me a job. I'm a convicted felon, and I'm 65 years old. So about a week later, when she realized she couldn't get me a job, she said, I know that you're prideful, but I'm going to give you $1,000 a month for a year so that you can start your nonprofit, which in the name of it is Witness to Mass Incarceration, and have you be settled. By giving me that money, and it wasn't that she made me rich, but she gave me enough money to pay my bills, to eat, and to have a year where I could build myself. It took one person to save my life, and I have to tell you that after 16 months of being homeless and penniless, I was the second time in my life I was ready to say goodbye to everybody. It was just too much. Now, most formerly incarcerated people leave prison without the ability to earn an income, and they don't come home with access to capital or with a family inheritance. They come home to correctional control, surveillance, and significant personal and community barriers. When I formed Witness, I wanted to do a lot of things, but one of the things I wanted to do was find a better system of reentry. So in New York, as in other cities and across this country, we have reentry services in the hundreds of millions of dollars, which all do transactional stuff. Again, meal, Metro cards, employment training, resume, and they give you a couple of job interviews. Some of them, you know, will send you to school. But you cannot build a life on what they give you. But more importantly, over the 30 years they've been in existence, recidivism hasn't gone down. There's no large increase in housing or long-term employment for anybody. So put simply, the current model doesn't work, or as we see in prison, it's not broken. It's working exactly as it's supposed to be, meaning it's maintaining the status quo and keeping us in transitional housing and marginalized. And my organization, Witness to Mass Incarceration, is committed to transformational change. We have our initiatives and our special projects are informed by my personal experience, and I try to design things that are going to make a difference. So our first initiative is called the Suitcase Project. And when I came home to no one, I wanted to make sure that people were met by someone, taken out for their first free world meal, and provide them with a suitcase that had a phone with minutes for a year, a computer, and $800 worth of gift certificates for phone, transportation, clothing, and toiletries. And we're having our second annual special summer event on July 17th called Suitcase Sunday, where we feature formerly incarcerated lead services and businesses, which I'll talk about in a minute. And at that event, we hope to give out 100 suitcases. So we're just starting to try to raise money to give newly released people those suitcases. As part of what I do, I create a digital library, which now has a significant number of interviews. And the reason I do this is that testimony is critical to ensuring people never forget not only genocides and the Holocaust, but in order to make people aware of what mass incarceration is. Our third area we focus on is eliminating sexual violence in confinement, and I work to build the leadership of people who are survivors of sexual violence so that they can speak about it publicly and make people aware there's no Me Too movement behind bars. But my most significant project is called the MAP Project. And I knew that if I couldn't get a job with 30 years of work history, that others with little to no history would have a difficult time. Prior to COVID, we had the highest level of unemployment of any single group since the Great Depression, 27% of our people prior to COVID. 43% of black women had prior to COVID were unemployed. So post-COVID, wage-earning jobs are not within our reach. And even though the government, in my opinion, has stupidly decided to focus on workforce development and skills, my feeling is that if you don't attach a job to a workforce training program, meaning guaranteeing a job after you teach someone something, then teaching someone Microsoft Office Word and then them not using it is another transactional stupid tool that people can't use.
Evie,
but
do you remember the they changed it to job partnership. Do you remember the CEDA program that was started years ago? It was a CEDA program where the government pays so much and the businesses pay so much to do exactly what you're talking about right now. People were given they were given training and they were given jobs. I remember a girl had gone on that CEDA program, and she ended up becoming a data entry operator for the social services. But there were so many, it was doing so well, and I believe it was during Governor Reagan's
time.
That's
why it was stopped.
Yes.
That's why
Governor Reagan took it away.
Listen, I'm old enough to have been the director of research for Community Mental Health Center, which had 28 decentralized facilities in West Philadelphia, and really helped the community. And Reagan got rid of them. And that's why we have mentally ill people all over the streets. There were structures that worked very well. But if they work very well and they help part of the population that's not important to another part of the population, then these programs are taken away.
I think
so
much money is put into research instead of actual hands-on.
Well, that's another point. Of which I would agree. I focus on helping formerly incarcerated business and service leaders. I focus on small business because 43% of the gross domestic product of the United States comes from small business, and small businesses produce the most jobs and the safest neighborhoods. So if we as a population, meaning formerly incarcerated business owners, are able to build our businesses and hire other formerly incarcerated people, then that's significant. So I created the first directory. Like if you wanted to get your hair cut from a formerly incarcerated person or get something catered, you couldn't find us. We exist nowhere on no list. So I built a first of its kind directory that does list. If you go to my website, you'll see the map, and you can hit up in New York and look at all the resources. Now, what we're in the middle of doing is constructing kind of like a mini Amazon for formerly incarcerated people that we're trying to fundraise to be able to build this e-commerce site so that you can go to one place and look up fitness centers and see anywhere in the country where to use one, where you can order bakery goods, where you can order eyeglasses. So we have so far in 1 year listed about 760 businesses, which is a lot because you have to find them. And what we're trying to do is begin to build the beginning of generational wealth for people who never had it. And the reason it's so important is there's major research done that shows that black business owners have a net worth that's 12 times that of black wage earners. However, black business owners earn only one-tenth of what white business owners earn. And so I think being a wage earner is great, but it doesn't allow you to save or make the kind of money a small business would make. And we're focused on building the wealth of that community, which is why we are having this outdoor event where we'll have people meet us, spend money with us, get to know us, be in proximity with us, and understand that we're not sitting around trying to figure out which bank to rob. We're sitting around trying to build new lives. And that's an important thing people need to know. I'm going to just stop for a sec. I will tell you that Jeff Deskovic of the Jeff Deskovic Foundation for Justice worked with me closely to I took 3 months out of this, actually 2 months out of this year because of the weather. In January, I realized it was freezing, and I began a campaign to raise money for hats, gloves, and socks for people, for 5,600 incarcerated people at Rikers. His organization was very involved, and we did raise $45,000 in 6 weeks and shipped the hats and gloves to Rikers Island, at which point they didn't give them out. And Jeff worked with me, and we put a lot of pressure. It took us 3 weeks to get them to give out the hats and gloves, and we still don't know today if everybody got them, but we hope so. So since it's 5:42, I just want to know if I would invite you and your audience to subscribe to my website, and that way you'll get an email and learn about the work we do.
I did want to ask you to give the audience your website, give the audience any information you want to give them pertaining to your organization or your email or whatever the case may be. Please do.
Okay. So it's witness, WITNESSTOMASS, and incarceration, incarceration.org. And if you go to join or subscribe, you can send me an email. And if you have a question, I'm happy to answer it. If you want to set up a time to talk, I'm happy to. And, of course, since we're trying to raise money for this outdoor event, if you can donate, that would be an amazing help because we're a small organization. We do a lot, but we're small. Can I answer some questions at this point, or would you like me to keep telling more of the story?
No, you know, you're very interesting, really. And one of the things is a lot of things that you spoke about, it doesn't only happen with the women. It happens with the males, too. But the thing is, you mentioned that one woman gave you $1,000. One person helped you. $1,000 a month. And look what it's done. It's helped you so much. And I say if everybody in the country was to do a little bit for those who are needy, you know, 100%. We wouldn't have the problems we have to. You mentioned, you know, so no one would have to go rob a bank. And that's the thing. If people just put some effort into trying to treat someone like they want to be treated. You know, I've been to some third world country. I'll tell you the lack of funding, the lack of everything. Some of these people have no food. They don't have clothing. They have no place to go. And they're living in these clay houses or whatever they're called. And here we are with everything. And people cannot be satisfied. And thank God for those blessings. They have to find some reason to hate somebody else or hate another culture, hate another gender, hate another religion. And here, somebody gives you $1,000 a month, and here you are now with your own organization, witness to mass incarceration, talking about the abuses that go on around the country. And that is really sad. It's really sad that people that are supposed to be overseeing and rehabilitating these people incarcerated are abusing, and so many people have committed suicide. And look at that one in Florida. These guards lock him in a shower stall and turn the water up to 180 degrees, scalded him to death, and the people on that block could hear him screaming for his life. You know, these kind of things don't happen unless they're barbaric, and that's what we're living in. We're living in a country where people are so judgmental, so hateful, so racist, so divided, so corrupt, so deceitful, so full of lies, using people. And then when somebody goes to prison, they do all these other things that make it even worse. And here we are in a pandemic where everybody should be trying to come together and find ways to help one another. And people coming out of the prisons, our government doesn't even know how to deal with that. We have a lot of government surplus in this country that's not even being used. Lands that are not being used. We got vocational students. I remember they built my house on Cape Cod, you know, in Osterville. My house was built 1.5 miles from the beach. We had the Ponds and Bath, the house, 3 miles from Craigville Beach, and 6 miles from the Kennedy compound. The schools built my house in 1972, a 3-bedroom home, and it cost me $11,000. All I had to pay for was the material. I had that house. I sold it in 1997 because a tragedy happened in my life, and I was so quick just to get away. I just couldn't deal anymore that I sold my house for $79,900, and the people that bought it sold it the following year for $250,000. This was
And as you started talking about the house, I was going to say, do you want to do a fundraiser for me? I'll come out there until I realize you sold the house.
And the thing is, these were vocational students that went there. They're the carpenters, the electricians. They went there with their professors. At the time, they would do one house a year. And my house was unfortunately the last house that was built in Barnstable. But you have these kids in the cities that are in the streets and everything. They had nowhere to go. A lot of them dropping out of school. They could get these kids to be renovating houses or apartment buildings or businesses or something. They could be doing that, and the kids would have some interest. I had 4 brothers and 2 sisters in the military, Marines, Air Force, and Army. And when 2 of my brothers went in, they dropped out of school in the 11th grade. They went in. Then they have it so that kids cannot go in the military if they don't graduate from high school or if they're not in college. So these kids drop out of school. What do? They go to the streets. They're not doing anything. So when you were talking about these things that can be done for these people coming out of prison, the quarry has kept them from doing anything because these quarries are preventing, they have to put that on their resumes or their application. So they're not getting jobs because of the quarries. They're out in the streets. They can't join the military because they didn't finish high school. And the kids that are doing vocational, these kids are dropping out. They don't know what to do. It's not just about sitting in school and listening to teachers. They want hands-on. So there's so much that can be done, even for those coming out of prison. They could have a transitional period for them and do something with
broken-down
buildings.
What we need is we need 6 months before someone gets out and 12 months following, we need a safety net.
Exactly.
Whether it's in the form of mutual aid, whether it's, we need 12 months where people can rebuild their lives, and it needs to be supported. And, you know, it costs anywhere from $300,000 to $500,000 to keep a person in prison a year because of how much money you have to pay for overtime for correctional officers and other things. And it would only cost, if you would take $3,000 a month, $36,000 a year, and allow people not the cash but pay their bills, they could have an apartment and they could start their lives at a much lower cost with much less trauma. So it's just insane.
And there is fun out there. I don't know if you or anybody ever thinks of it, but because I do extensive research, you go on the internet and you type in financial aid or funding for ex-offenders. There's monies out there. There's monies that will put them, let them go to school, education, or whatever. And there's philanthropists out there that are for criminal justice reform or for social justice. There's philanthropists out there.
But you know what? It's not very easy. So I can tell you that I was very well funded in 2020. I was horribly funded in 2021 because funders tend to fund the same people over and over again. And so there are a lot of amazing formerly incarcerated people doing really great work, but for whom it's a constant struggle to get funding. It's a constant struggle for me to get funding because I'm competing against organizations that are not run by formerly incarcerated people that serve our population, but who don't have the same, I'm sorry to say, if you weren't in prison, you can't want it as badly as we do to help other people who you've either left behind or who are coming out.
That's true. A lot of people don't have the investment in the prisons as many of us. But the thing is, too, I started my organization in 2004, and I never had funding. I never applied, which I wish I had now. But what happens is I registered the organization with universities across the country, law students, psychology majors, social workers, they wanted to do their internships. They wanted to get the experience. So I was getting a lot of volunteers that were in all these areas. A lot of these places, these organizations that do get funding don't do anything. And prisoners will tell you. But that's how you can provide. And then I registered with the United States Postal Service, FedEx, and UPS. We were getting nonprofit mail. Instead of paying 47 cents for a stamp, we're able to pay 11 cents. And that's something you might want to check out even for your organization, Witness to Mass Incarceration, because you will get nonprofit nonprofit reductions in your postage, in your FedEx and UPS. But these are all things that they can actually apply for. There's a lot of freebies. You put freebies for nonprofits, even nonprofit lawyers out there that will help. But people don't try to access all the free things that they can get or the pro bono things that they can get.
Well, you have to look, I start working at 9 o'clock in the morning and I will finish working. It's Friday night, not till late tonight, but usually between 7 and 9 o'clock, and I'm sitting in the chair. And I'm too busy to look for some of those things. I have to look for the funding that I require. I need staff. That's $50,000-$60,000. I can't, if I'm one person, I am working with 750 formerly incarcerated people on the map. I'm working with survivors of sexual violence. I'm getting phone calls from mothers and cousins with people in prison every day to see if I can provide them with something. There's just no, for me to look at freebies, to be honest, I don't have the time. And it's also when you calculate how much time that you are going to spend and what you're going to get out of it, you have to be really clear on what you need to do to survive. So this year I did not get very much funding. I survived by not taking a salary and doing as little as possible. And I have a lot of interns. But even if you have interns and volunteers who are wonderful, you still have to tell them what to do.
Yeah.
So
and
the
you
more
know what?
Free
you can
help.
Also, on volunteermatch.com, and United Way, register your organization with them. You can post for positions, volunteer grant writers. You can post for volunteer researchers. You can post for volunteer whatever. And that way, you'll have somebody doing the research for you. Get the volunteer.
But I just want to say, I have 25 interns, different universities from across the United States. It is a lot of work to manage. A volunteer is wonderful, but they don't know your work. And I'm exhausted in a great way and revitalized by having all these wonderful interns from different universities. But I have to work with them in order. They're not grant writers. They are wannabe grant writers. They're not journalists. They're wannabe journalists. They're not. They do social media for themselves. They don't necessarily do social media that a advertising firm would do. You're dealing with young kids who have well-intentioned, but in order for me to make use of their wonderful energy, I have to work with them all day.
Yeah. Do you have a boss? Do you have a vice president or a chief of staff or anything like that?
No, it's me. I can't afford it. I don't have enough funding.
Volunteer.
I am the sole. I have the 25. Well, no, I still have to direct them. The more people you have, the more less time you have to do. If I want to do public speaking in order to raise awareness, I have to do it after a 12-hour day of directing my volunteers. Just remember, it's exhausting. I have teams. I have a team of development interns. I have a team of journalist interns. I have a team of social media interns. But they can't. They're all wanting to learn. They're not experienced. So it only works because my entire day is spent directing the traffic. What I really need is $60,000 to give someone a salary for a year who can be a staff person. And for that, I need to write grants.
Yeah.
You know, or find individual donors which I have not had the fortune to find those kind of individual donors.
Well,
and this is a problem for it. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
We have about 3 minutes, so you can talk about or get it out there the type of funding that you need or the type of help that you need, and maybe recruit somebody from listeners.
Okay. So the most wonderful thing would be, you know, I didn't do this early enough, but I have not built up my individual donor database enough, and I have not built up. I would love to have people who could do a house party for me, or people who are in a resort area that would be willing to help in this area. I have a good story to tell, but I need, it's not only the individual donor who may send $100. I need someone who can bring people to their house and I can speak. I need larger individual donors as well as small ones.
Yeah.
But that's where I need the help.
Have you also gone to the universities to speak or done any workshops with the universities, the students?
So prior to COVID, I spoke all over the country, including the White House during the Obama years. I spoke at Yale and Harvard Law. I did nothing but travel. I went to Los Angeles just before COVID. February of 2020, I did 14 talks in 7 days.
Wow.
Most of the talks were at synagogues. And by the time I came home, I was exhausted. So I love public speaking, and I will be setting up an intense public speaking. I will be traveling to various cities and speaking in public, probably starting in September, depending on COVID. If not in person, then it'll be on Zoom. But I just spoke at Cornell last week, and every week I speak at another university.
Well, I'll tell you,
we
definitely have to have you back on the show with the follow-up of all the work you're doing. And, again, give the audience your contact information and everything, and anyone that's out there that would want to donate some amount of money, whether it be a small amount or large, just go to Evvy Litlock. You want to give them your website again?
The website is witnesstomassincarceration.org, which is spelled witnesstomassincarceration.org.
And
if you write to me, I'll answer back.
And I will be checking the website, too. I thank you for coming on at the last minute. I really appreciate you. I want to thank Jeffrey Deskovic for having you come on. And again, we're going to have Jeffrey on next Thursday, same time, and he will be talking about the achievements he's made throughout the years. But Jeffrey is a lawyer out of New York for the wrongfully convicted who, like Ms. Litwack, went through a lot, and he was only 16 when he went into prison, or 17, and he was coerced, but again, he was wrongfully convicted as well. And so I want to thank you, Evie, and I do want to have you back on, and we can talk after, sometime after the show or sometime next week.
Okay, thank you.
It was an honor. Thank you so much. And Joe, if you're listening in, thank you for listening in with us, and hopefully next time we'll have more people calling in as well. So thank you so much. And we are going to end this episode. Thank you all for listening in. Thank you for coming on. And I will definitely look forward to our next show with Evie Litwack. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.